This is Glenn Livingston.
And David Bullock.
How are you today, sir?
I'm fine.
David and I have been talking for a while about our various approaches to marketing research and marketing intelligence, all really aimed at enhancing the conversion of any sales process. People tend to think of us as the online geeks, if you will. Really, we both come from offline corporate consulting background where we learned and cut our teeth on fairly large deals. In my case, it was advertising. David, I think in your case, it was
capital equipment. I was doing a lot of large automation sales into the automotive industry.
Yeah, you did over $100 million of sales.
Right.
Yeah.
Those are my numbers.
Yeah. I worked with companies rolling out multi-million dollar advertising campaigns and, you know, international research studies. Why don't we start with you, Dave? Why don't you tell me a little bit about how you came to evolve your methodology and how you're looking at markets now and what you're trying to accomplish these days?
Well, it really started in 2003 when I was looking at an Inc. magazine article I read about, as I've spoken before, James Kowalik. He had figured out how to use the Taguchi methodology with advertising. And he actually worked with Dr. Taguchi for several years. I mean, they've been personal friends for 20 years. So, you know, it really all started there. But I met Dr. Kowalik after I had done all the sales development, all the business development, all the invention. I had patents under my belt. So when I met Dr. Kowalik, this was basically the icing on the cake of the process engineering, the sales, marketing, and now I have this new tool that allows me to optimize a process, and it was any process. I mean, he showed me how to use it with recipes for salsa and vanilla wafers, and then we applied that to advertising. And this was a very deep rabbit hole, but it got even more interesting when he introduced me to his innovation methodologies.
I'm sure that most people listening will know what the Taguchi method is, which, for clarification, if we were going to do a first grade synopsis of the Taguchi method, we would say that it's an ad optimization algorithm of sorts that allows you to test thousands of possible combinations and many, many variables at once so that you optimize your sales process much, much faster than traditional split testing or full factorial testing, yes?
That was good. I'm make it even simpler than that. It's split testing on steroids. I mean, you can split test one thing at a time. Here you're going to check multiple things at the same time and get a result with less time, less effort, and less money spent.
Yep.
So it's a time saver more than anything else.
Gotcha.
And it's been used in just about every application known to man, from direct mail to pay-per-click to landing page response to the automotive industry building engine. So it's pretty robust and been around for like the last 40 years. That's where it started with the Taguchi method. Dr. Kowalik introduced me to that. But then the thinking, there was something they think called esoteric Taguchi, which is a different way of thinking about processes and what the impacts are in the environment. And when that thinking started to really take hold, and it took about a year, year and a half, then a whole new world opened up, and then I got started to get introduced to the innovation methodologies. Because what we found was having the tools are great. I mean, you can have something like the Taguchi methodology, which will tell you exactly what to do, but the question is you have to have very good inputs into the test so that it works. Having the tools is one thing, but knowing what to do with the tools to actually make them work is something completely different. And that took me down a completely different path for about 2 years.
Kind of like that slogan for Othello.
Oh, yeah.
A minute to learn how to play, a lifetime to master.
Exactly. And I'm finding that there's this huge rabbit hole of business innovation that has come about from learning the Taguchi method and then realizing it was just a tool, but you had to figure out how to create innovative inputs. That took me into TRIZ. TRIZ, which is a Russian innovation methodology based on the analysis of millions of patents. But from that methodology, Dr. Kowalik showed me something which is about four levels above trees, which is called higher level thinking. That allows you to look at any problem, break it down into very small pieces, and innovate within the problem itself to get different outputs. So I'm applying that now to everything. The world does not look the same to me anymore.
So to summarize what I understand about you, you discovered this split testing on steroids.
Right.
And then you realized that as powerful as it was just a tool, and it was only as good as what you would put into the algorithm, into the computer. And then you investigated a Russian creative input generation formula called TRIZ, T-R-I-Z. And that was based on the analysis of of patents.
Mm-hmm.
And then that led you to higher level thinking tools for, I didn't quite follow it, for producing output, for producing different input.
It actually does both. If you produce the proper inputs, the outputs exponentially increase. The nice thing is that from a business development standpoint, if you apply this thinking anywhere along your sales cycle, you get increases, you get differentiations, you get innovations that are deemed profitable. It's kind of like your search continuum. Your thinking allowed you to be able to see an insight as to how people actually are looking for products and services. Because what I was doing in the marketplace, new thinking arises, actually far and above the tools that could ever be created, because the thinking allows you to use and recombine the tools that you currently have in the marketplace. So you and I both, we have tools which are available. You use keyword tools and surveys and Excel spreadsheets for analysis. Those tools already exist. What I find so masterful about what you've done is you've been able to reconfigure those to get a specific output from the system.
Yeah, it's all about the mindset and the way that you look at the data and, you know, how you analyze it.
Exactly. I'm learning more and more that it is not about the tools. It's about the thinking, to be able to really see what you can see in your marketplace, to connect with the customer, and then to develop things that the customer will respond to.
I'm wondering if an example might not help people understand.
Okay, innovation. One of the things that we looked at on a website is what could we put in between the website and the person's eyes so that they would respond. Now, seemingly, that is a very obvious question or a very obvious thing to do. But what we found is that we started testing things like video and audio and removing things from the page to find out what needed to be in betwixt this computer screen and people's eyes to make them respond. And from that, we found out the criteria for items on a page are...
The main point that you made just before was that there was a real difference between just using the tools and using them effectively with creative input and creative output. And I thought if you maybe had a good example of someone who came to you and was trying to use the tool...
Got it. A very good example of using creative inputs or using higher-level thinking to create the inputs is I had a client just 2 weeks ago, and they were creating headlines for their campaign, and they sell a gardening device. But what came out of it was that they had the headlines, and the headlines all said the exact same thing because they could not get out of their own head. What I found out is that copywriters, as well as most business people, think the same way, so they are in the same conversation with themselves. Subsequently, they're in the same conversation with their customer.
So even if they think that they're writing 20 different headlines, they're all just slight variations on a theme.
They were the very same headline over and over again. And what was so interesting is that I could not articulate to the customer that I was saying these headlines need to be different. But I could not articulate exactly what different meant. But in working with them, what I found out was this. If your headline does not give a very different mental picture in the person's mind, for instance, that famous headline that says, they laughed at me when I sat down at the piano, but then when I began to play.
Right.
If you look at that, that has a very significant emotional and psychological, as well as physical image that it puts into your head. Look at those 10 words.
You know, it paints a picture, and there's a psychological test called the thematic perception test, the TAT.
Mm-hmm.
And basically you show people a picture and you ask them to tell a story about it, and you tell them that the story has a beginning, middle, and an end, and you know something about what the characters are thinking, feeling, and doing.
Mm-hmm.
And what I associated to your presentation there was that maybe that's a good test for a headline that would be a good input. It would be something that really conjures up a picture that's, you know, a snapshot of a story that has a beginning, middle, and an end, and you can think about what people are thinking, feeling, and doing.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
But like that guy on the piano sitting down.
Like the guy on the piano there. One of the things that came out of my research, which actually was in linguistics and semantics, I mean, I went deep into what words do and how they actually impact us. I'm big on stories. There's a book by Robert Tobias. It's called The Master Plots. I think I spoke about this before, where it talks about there are 20 very robust stories that all human beings are in. David and Goliath, the underdog, excess wealth, a fall from grace. These are stories that we see over and over again, and we respond to. The question is, from the innovation side on inputs, it's what story does that input, say that headline or that picture, convey? What story is the customer in, and is the story consistent with your advertisement?
Gotcha. So it's almost like there is this episode of Star Trek: The Next Generation. I don't know if you ever saw that, or if I sound like too much of a geek. But there's this episode where a culture communicated only with the headlines of stories. Gorak and Nuffram.
Yes, I remember.
Yeah, I remember. And it's almost like what you've discovered, what you're saying, is that there's a handful, maybe two or three dozen at most, of archetypical stories that hit the core emotional hot buttons that make people buy. And it sounds like what you're doing with your work is you're trying to identify which of those stories are most consistent with the product features and benefits, with the way that the advertisement is written.
Well, that's it exactly. Because my methodology is more about what do you see on the page and what's it doing to you. Your methodology is more along the lines that you figure out all the conversations that a person could possibly be in before they are in the buying situation. While I'm actually doing none of that work at all, I'm only finding out why they're in the buying situation, what story are they in, and what most resonates right there when they're in purchase mode.
I see it as what's working for you is having pre-identified these 20 stories and intercepting people at the point of action.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
I intercept the people at the point of action, but rather than pre-classify people in the 20 stories, I'm looking to see how, you know, the conversation in their head comes together for this market in particular when they're buying. I think we probably both reached the same conclusion. It's more like I think that you start with the forest and you fill in the trees, and I start with the trees and I fill in the forest.
Yeah, you're right, because the bottom line is that conversions go up, buyers buy more.
Yeah.
And so we get to the same spot. The first time I started thinking about your methodology versus mine, I started looking at, I'm more of a brute force. I mean, it's a forced survey in the moment. Here you go. I'm really not looking to match their language. I am matching their language, but I'm doing it via their inputs a little bit further in the stage. I'm doing a brute force survey. I'm not asking any questions. I want to know what you're going to do right now.
You're saying people, not that they vote with their feet, but they vote with their wallet, and you will infer what's making the money come out of the wallet by looking at the differences in the pages that get the money to come out of the wallet.
Exactly.
When I developed my methodology, I had just lost $2 million, and so I was very, very risk averse.
Yes.
By the way, I didn't have $2 million to lose. It was not fun. It was really not fun. And I was extremely risk-averse. So rather than jump out into a market and put up a possible sales page before I've really understood what these people are thinking, I go in and I break up the market into as many pieces as I can beforehand, and I survey them to find out exactly what they're thinking and what level of frustration they're having in front of the answer to their problem in each separate segment of the market. And you know, that way I can estimate my cost of acquisition, because the portions of the market that are responding more thoroughly and indicating that they're feeling more frustrated finding information, I actually have a little metric that helps me figure out from that percentage of people in that part of the market what percentage of people are actually going to sign up for a newsletter and what percentage of people are actually going to buy something if I offer them something comparable to what's out there. I can actually go through and eliminate the unprofitable pathways beforehand. And I'm ruthless about that because I just don't want to take the risk. Sometimes I think maybe I'm really banging my head against the wall and I should do more of what David does, because he jumps in there and he puts something out and it's got people voting with their wallets right away. And I think your time to market is much quicker than my time to market. The downside for me is the downside risk is always really small.
Interesting. Well, you're right. When I came into the market and started to apply my methodology, say the pay-per-click, I mean, that's where it was more of a, I don't believe that this can work. Because Doc used to tell me that pay-per-click, you can buy traffic, which means you can buy conversations on a day-to-day basis. There has to be a way to make that work. But the distinction was, we realized that you have a very interesting contrast with pay-per-click. You want people to click, but you really don't. Because clicking is both a helpful act as well as a harmful act.
What do you mean?
Oh, my gosh. If someone sees your ad and they click on it and they're not qualified, it costs you money.
Oh, sure.
Okay? So, and I remember we were sitting at the table one day, and he said, David, can you explain to me the contradiction with pay-per-click? And I said, yes, it's, I want you to click, but if you're not going to buy, I don't want you to click.
Got it.
Okay? And I remember that conversation so well, because it really set my mind to say, how do I create ads, or how do I create campaigns that if I don't even want you to see my ad, if you are not going to buy, or if you're not predisposed to buy? So that's my thinking that I went into the marketplace with. It just so happened that my segmentation, like I have one campaign that has 85 keywords and there's 20 different segments there. So I probably came to the same conclusion that you came to, but I just came about it a little bit differently. The segmentation is key. Segment that channel, because I don't want you to even see my ad unless you're going to buy.
Okay, trying to put my head around where this overlap is. There's one way in which we overlap very much like that, and then there's another way where I think that we might be a little bit different. I think that the contradiction in the pay-per-click, which basically what you're saying is you only want highly qualified people to click on your ad.
Yes.
Otherwise, you're spending money for tire pickers.
Exactly.
That would be reflected in like the estimated cost of acquisition that I get on the surveys, because if I'm getting a lot of unqualified people clicking, I would find that it's costing me a lot of money to generate a single survey, and
mm-hmm.
I would go back and I try to revise the ad or revise the survey somewhat to get the match right so that I've got a reasonable cost per survey, because that's my metric that corresponds to cost per acquisition and cost
yep.
per sale.
Mm-hmm.
So in that respect, I think we're really after the same exact thing. The place that I think maybe I'm a little bit different is that I also said to myself, there's a difference between, I've heard it put in different ways, like Alex Vandozian says there's a suspect and then there's a prospect and then there's a lead, right? And I think that a suspect is someone who just kind of like types in the keyword and sees your ad, and a prospect might be someone who kind of clicks on it, and a lead is someone who's going to actually fill out a form and want a relationship with you in some way. I became intrigued with the process of converting the suspects. What I always say to myself is, where is it that every other marketer is going to be kicking themselves and saying, I just can't do this? That's where the greatest opportunity is going to be. And especially online, like someone who just types in the word guinea pig, there's loads and loads of traffic in that one word, but they're not really ready to buy a guinea pig or even necessarily to sign up for a newsletter just yet, because they're tire kicking. They're trying to figure out what the market is like, and they need an education. And what I wanted to figure out was, how do people proceed from searching for guinea pig, where they're kind of tire kicking, to a guinea pig care, which is someone who's a little more serious and thinking, maybe I want to get one for my kid, and you know, the guinea pig cage is someone who's really now looking to build or buy a cage, so they're going to take a guinea pig home to go rescue a guinea pig or something like that.
Okay.
That's a silly example, but it's illustrative.
Mm-hmm.
Because I think that if you can understand that whole continuum, if you can understand the continuum from the remotely interested buyer to the highly qualified lead or prospect, and you can understand how that mindset evolves as people continue to search, because search is usually not an isolated event. It goes from the first word to the second word, and they read a couple of pages, and then they pick up some more words and they type them in. I think that if you can pick them up early, then, first of all, you can intercept them on much less expensive advertising in a pay-per-click environment. The early words are less expensive because they don't convert as well. And there's a lot less competition because the other marketers don't know how to do it. And so you wind up with all this volume and no competition, and you can just blow people away. But you have to understand how to step people from A to B to C to D.
Interesting.
So I think that the real power is in combining the two. I think the real power is in understanding how to develop a qualification process, because
mm-hmm.
you don't want to spend too much energy and resources on people that are not genuinely interested,
mm-hmm.
but then also understanding how do you get the people that are not quite qualified yet to want to be qualified.
Well, see, that's one of the points. When I set up my experiment, the very first one that I did, it was the worst conditions known to man, meaning no capture page, I wasn't trying to do any follow-up, it was a one-shot. You're in, you're going to buy, or you're not going to buy. And so I set up my initial experiment with, unlike yours, you're anticipating a low-level cost of entry and then stepping them through a continuum to get them to buy.
Yeah.
That part of the experiment, I deliberately negated that part to see, could I get a one-shot sale directly? Again, I set up an experiment, so I was trying to get a visceral response that they were compelled to buy now based on the copy. And considering I'm getting still, even with that same experiment, a 5X ROI return each and every month, and it's been doing that for 18 months. Again, without any follow-up, I kept that experiment extremely cool, without any follow-up. From that data, I realized that you could create a site or a situation which was so compelling that people would buy. But what I found that you have to do is you have to handle on that page the person at the level A, do the level, I'm going to buy now.
What's really appealing about that type of a process, besides the fact that if you want to set up a business with no customer service and don't have to deal with autoresponders,
mm-hmm.
I think that if you're really going to build a business, my process is more laborious than yours. I'd say about 200 hours to put together a project. And
I hear you.
But what I'm thinking is, gosh, if I went into a market using David's process where we really hit build a sales letter, we know the sales letter is working. And then I add all of the search continuum information.
Oh, it's incredible.
Yeah.
Because of my upbringing in the engineering and manufacturing side, there's inherent need for speed for everything that I do. I mean, I want to get the keywords, identify the market, drop into the market, and start testing, know what's happening. Am I making money? Yes or no? Because there is no maybe. Either my cost of customer acquisition is lower than my profitability per customer acquired or not. Either I'm making money or I'm not making money. With some of my early experiments, my cost per testing period may be 30 days and $75. I'm in and I'm out. But after that 30-day period, it starts to climb because now I've honed in on the process. I work with clients now and they say, well, how long will it take you to set up? I say, well, I'll be ready by tomorrow. And the pages are set. Do you have traffic? Yes or no? Good. Well, the traffic's there. Good. The pages are set. And I'm starting to get data immediately. Now, the point that becomes very significant here is that when I'm designing the inputs themselves are such designed so that they tell a complete story, so I know what story I need to be in.
Yeah.
And which trees, for lack of a better term, I need to bark up, or which channels I need to amplify.
Every time you and I talk, I start to feel very megalomaniacal. I think you and I can just take over the world.
The thinking is, again, quick, and when I saw your methodology, I understood the thinking. It made sense. The search continuum made, and I've incorporated that thinking into my keyword research, but I'm still popping up the pages. And sending the traffic and starting to test to find, and once it's profitable, then I roll out more traffic to that same test.
You've spoken with Ari Galper, mm-hmm. who's got another very unique and different technique for assessing a market and improving conversion. And we all three have access to each other's tools and technologies, and I think that in part it's a matter of personality, where what lens you want to look at the market with. And I know intellectually that it would be best to look at the market from all three perspectives.
Mm-hmm.
As I'm looking at some very expensive markets now, and as I'm doing that, you know, I've got a bunch of money in the bank from previous projects, and I can afford to risk a bunch. I'm going to be implementing all three of these methodologies so I really don't miss anything, but you become comfortable with one way of looking at the world, and when you have the level of success that we've had, it's kind of hard to want to do the other guys.
Believe me, I understand. I know what I'm doing in my little piece, but when I'm exposed to you or I'm exposed to Ari's thinking, and I can see Ari is getting the people, getting their language in the conversation to plug up every hole on the site. There's everything needs to be here to facilitate the sale. He's more in buying facilitation mode. Great. That makes sense. In any business, in any time, you're looking at, I want to know what the conversations are before I even start. That makes absolute sense. Really, I'm looking at both of your methodologies to provide inputs. So really, all I'm really testing is, what is the sequence? What are the most important stories I have to tell? And which of those stories need to be amplified to have an emotional and or instantaneous visceral response to the advertisement so that that person, in an analogy, rips newspaper page out, ad in hand, jumps into their car and comes to visit me at the store.
Right.
Because I come from an offline, my experience is belly-to-belly sales, when sometimes there's $1 million riding on that PO being signed or getting agreement. That being said, that idea of they saw it, they understood it, and they want to buy now.
It's actually a very important point you're bringing up I wanted to ask you about, because whatever method you use, you have to set a criterion for success, right?
Yes.
So that whether you're using Taguchi, whether you're doing surveys or running regressions or doing some of the things that I do, you've got to decide what behavior do you want the user to take, and then all of the optimization is towards that end.
Yes.
I'm correct about that with Taguchi also, yes?
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah. What I'm wondering is, when you do a typical project, are you always looking to generate the order online and that's the goal toward which you're optimizing for, or will you sometimes run a Taguchi test to drive phone calls or to drive, like you said, in-store visits or something like that?
Yes, I do different things. Sometimes I'm looking for just the opt-in. Sometimes I'm looking for the opt-in with the phone number so that a follow-up call can be made. The opt-in page is not so much a pull to get more information or to get them into an autoresponder series. Sometimes I want them to raise their hand, take action so that a contact can be made. So every time I design a test or an experiment for any of my clients, I'm looking at, what is this process that we're in? Now we've broken it down into pieces. Now what is the purpose of this piece of the process? I.e., if you're doing keyword research, you're looking for a keyword conversation, that keyword and the ad itself is to do nothing more than to just start and initiate the conversation. to put them over to the opt-in page. Now, if you have a lower cost product where you can almost get an impulse buy, you want to dope people over into your sales process as quickly as possible. Whereas, if you have a process like, say, the person is going to start paying you $5,000 to $10,000 a month for consulting, I don't want anyone who can't afford that to even see the page and or opt in, because then I have to call them and find out that they're disqualified. So depending on what you're doing, you have to be very sure and very clear on the purpose of that part of the process. Do you want to stop them there, or do you want to just pull them forward so you can engage them in another way?
Gotcha. So you really have to define what you're trying to get them to do before you can use any of these tools.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
In direct marketing, and very much in the internet marketing niche and all the educational materials that are available, for the most part, it seems like people are promoting unipurpose pages. So there's a singular you're laughing. There's a singular call to action, and everything is geared towards getting the person to order or getting the person to opt in. But sometimes there's more than one goal that a page has. Like, there are some markets where it's kind of hard to get a foothold where you might want to have AdSense and an opt-in form on the page. There are some markets where you might want to have an opt-in and an order form on the page. I'm wondering, when you run a Taguchi test, how do you take that into consideration? I've got ways that I do it with my multivariate test, but I'm curious how you do it with yours.
We usually run a split-level test. I call it the yes and no phase. An opt-in form being, does it help me or hurt me? Yes, either it's there or it's not. And I actually run two-level tests that way, where I say I'm running seven different items, but I'm only going two levels deep, meaning there or not there.
When you say that it helps you or doesn't help you, it's towards what end? Towards making the sale or towards?
So much depends. If it's an opt-in page and I'm earnestly trying to get opt-ins, let's look at what an opt-in really is. An opt-in is future traffic. That's really all it really is. When you get that email, what you are doing is you are storing up the possibility of having traffic to your website later because you're in a communication.
Like potential energy.
It's potential energy. That's exactly what it is, because the reader has to put energy into the page so that they move forward with the page. If the reader shows up and has no energy to move forward with the transaction because they have no need or concern, you go nowhere in the sales cycle. Knowing that and looking at that, you have to decide, okay, opt-in. Do I want these people on my list? Yes or no? Good. If you decide yes, what needs to be on this page so that people will opt into my list? And do I have something to say to them later, either by phone, fax, or mail, and or email, such that they will move forward in the transaction which I'm throwing them to? Now, what I find is this. In the internet marketing space, there is that general idea, if I just get the lead, if I just get the email, I'm going to bombard these people with so many different offers, somebody's going to buy.
Right.
Okay? And that is why you have these unipurpose opt-in forms. The segmentation is not there to know what conversations those people really want to be in so that they will accept your offer. They're working on the law of large numbers and not the law of, I am in the proper conversation with these people. Case in point, I haven't sent any ancillary offers to my list ever. They don't see anything else.
You're really trying to maintain a laser-targeted message-to-market match.
Absolutely. It's a keyword conversation, and when these people say David Bullock, come across ad optimization, they know that it's me telling them about this type of product that will do this type of thing for them. Now, I am always looking for other methodologies and or tools which help that process, meaning better innovation for the inputs, a better tools for organization of the project itself so that people actually do execute. Always doing that, but the idea of just throwing offer upon offer upon offer to my list is out of the question, to me.
Oh, sure.
For me.
Well, no, because when you do that, what you're really doing is training people not to read your email.
Exactly. Funniest thing is that I found that the response rates on the email, people respond back to my emails. Hi, Dave, I've read everything about you. I read your blog. I went to your various site. I read your offer. I have a few questions, and then an order shows up.
Yeah.
That's the best conversation to have. I love that conversation. And then if they say, well, I have a question, well, look, speak to one of my students or speak to such and such, get that question answered, and feel free to give me a call back. Now I'm in a real conversation with that individual, and they don't just see themselves as someone that I'm throwing offers to with the possibility that they might buy if it catches their fancy or my copy is right. I'm looking for real relationships here with small to mid-sized businesses that grow into large to mid-sized businesses. Not, I'm a marketer selling marketing information to other marketers to sell to other marketers. That's not the idea. I don't live in that market at all.
Just on a practical level, what tools do you use to?
The world is about to get really mad at me. I use an Excel spreadsheet for doing my analysis, one that I created some years ago.
That's funny. I did the same thing.
I use an Excel spreadsheet. I use a simple rotator and a simple tracker. My admin and I handwrite the various pages because we can control them better, and we put them in the marketplace with a regular standard rotator and a regular standard tracker.
So there's nothing to buy?
No, there isn't. Not anymore. It's an evolution. And let me tell you what happened. I pushed very hard early on because I thought this was such an arduous process. You got to do 12 different pages. Oh, my gosh. And because I was doing it and I didn't have a method for doing it easily and effectively, it was difficult to get done. But now that I have a method as to, okay, here's the master page. Okay, the subpages come from there. Okay, the subpage. Okay, I'm done. I'm done. I'm in and out of a test setup from a mechanical standpoint within an hour and a half. I'm done. So I push very hard to create these tools, great tools, but they don't work in every environment. As soon as I ran into some environments that would not run the PHP or the Java was not getting the cookie drop correctly, I found out I had a problem. I wanted tools that worked and deployed quickly and easily, not newfangled tools that looked nice but didn't give me the result that I wanted. So, yeah, now I use a tracker, a rotator.
That's so funny. I don't know if I don't know if the people listening to this are going to be part of the internet marketing crowd or not, but the history was Perry Marshall kind of announced you to the world and took the internet by storm, and everybody was trying to figure out how to do Taguchis, and what was it, 2 weeks later there were...
Oh, gosh, five different other pools, again, other tools.
All these tools jumped out, and you could pay $300 a month for this or $300 a month for that. In the meantime, it turns out that David Bullock is sitting with a spreadsheet and a version of Notepad to make decisions.
The funniest thing is look at what really goes on here. You have to have some variation which goes into the marketplace. The marketplace sees it. They vote with their dollars. You have to see which one won, which one didn't win. Do the analysis. The analysis tells you pay attention to this and don't pay attention to that. Try this formula and it will probably work based on the actual algorithm, and that's it. Again, it's gone full circle for me because, again, I was in a situation with a client where I had my best tool and it wouldn't work because the environment would not allow it to work. It just would not. I went back to, okay, what do I know works? Oh, I know this works. I have absolute control. I don't have to worry about the code working or not working or showing the wrong creative, or I don't have to worry about that. It works. This works. You saw that? Great. Did you respond? Yes or no? All the setup, I can be in and out of a test really and truly in about an hour and a half, fully set up, done.
Perfect. So, David, if you're not really getting your traffic from pay-per-click nowadays, where are you getting your traffic?
I've moved into a whole Web 2.0 article generation, blog generation, social networking. I'm really trying to connect with the people where they want to be connected as opposed to trying to pay for it. I have a team in place now that handles all those aspects of traffic generation. And with the social networking now becoming more and more prevalent with, say, Delicious and Technorati and the MySpace and the 43 things, you can actually get traffic almost instantaneously.
Really?
Oh, my gosh, Squidoo? Oh, my goodness. And I'm working with clients now and found out several problems with doing what I do as I was working as a consultant early on. First thing, people don't have traffic. They don't. So I had to learn to go get traffic.
Right.
So I did. So I learned how to go get traffic without doing any of the search engine spamming or any using any of those mechanical tools, but I actually have a team.
It's all white hat.
Oh, it's all white hat. Because that way I can build an infrastructure and it stays there forever and I don't have to worry about it coming down. So I build it once it's there. And now with the prevalence of the Web 2.0 social networking, actually Web 3.0 stuff which is coming around the corner, you can actually get traffic almost instantaneously. There's a shift now in the marketplace where the search engines are now looking for recency and relevance. And not, it's been here forever, and it's been seasoned.
Gotcha.
And that being said, to know how to take advantage of that lends itself to a whole different level of traffic generation, both in a local market, especially because local markets are wide open. Local market SEO is really untapped. For instance, a chiropractor that is here in Murfreesboro, Tennessee, does not need traffic from California.
And the odds of there being an expert SEO guy who went after all the Murfreesboro, Tennessee traffic is pretty...
slim to none. It's all white hat. I have a team in place that handles all of it, and I can basically say I want this market, and we deploy an 8-step process in that one market, and we can get all the white hat traffic that we want, and again, almost instantaneously, really within 15 minutes of deployment.
I'm relatively quiet in this part of the conversation because I, you know, when I first started internet marketing, I learned that you could either be an expert at conversion or be an expert at traffic. And so I've kind of ignored everything about getting traffic except for pay-per-click and and also I'm very good at public relations. I can get in the paper and TV and stuff. I figured that whoever has the best sales pitch wins. So I work on having the best sales pitch and the best way of segmenting my market so I could avoid bothering people with irrelevant messages and laser targets with the right messages. That's worked for me because then affiliates will come to me and say, well, can I promote your stuff?
Oh, yeah, but your market and your model is very different than mine. I realized that I deal with big offers, $600, $6,000 per pop offers, things that are industrial. I call it the corporate community, where the corporation will buy 25,000 of this and it fits right into their infrastructure. And I realized that because that's where I came from, I applied a lot of the manufacturing methodologies, large-scale methodologies, to what I do. I'm looking for one-to-many leverage all the time. And affiliates, I've not really delved very deeply into that mode of creating traffic because, for instance, I have a client now, 360,000 people on their mailing list. That is traffic. Why do I need a lot of affiliates when I have that pent-up demand sitting? It needs to be what? Segmented, proper offer.
Segmented, studied, and converted.
That's it. Again, I looked at the reverse of what normally has to happen, which is, okay, I have to go find traffic. Okay, good. I have to go make offers. Great. And I have to go build the mailing list. Okay, great. Go back the other way. Let me go find the people who already have market presence. It's like the ultimate joint venture. Go find the presence in the marketplace already and then plug into that the offers that people there are willing to buy. It's so much easier.
What's your biggest challenge nowadays?
Finding the proper clients that I want to work with, really. I get calls on a day-to-day basis because my offer has gone beyond testing and tracking and Taguchi to business development. Let me look at your business and let's see where we can monetize your business differently. Because if you do something different, you will get a different result. So it's almost like business innovation. But it's really trying to find out people who can see my offer and can really grasp it. I'm looking at your business as a totality. For instance, if you, okay, you have a website. Okay, how are you getting traffic? Lovely. Or is that traffic converting? Okay, what else do you need? Okay, good. Are you building this mailing list? Good. Are you tapping that asset? There are about 67 ways to monetize any community, meaning any mailing list, and most people only handle two of them.
So your ideal client would be a client with a large mailing list already doing $500,000 a year who's got an understanding of direct marketing principles and understands that the optimization techniques that you provide can be applied to every aspect of the business?
Yes.
And those people are kind of few and far between.
They are few and far between, but when I get that call that someone has read everything about me and it, and the methodology, they seem to rise to the top and then contact me. Again, my marketing and or my PR is created specifically to find those people. It's not created to sell a particular product.
Right.
To draw those people out of the woodwork so that they say, oh, my gosh, this guy can help me.
But you kind of have to widgetize your expertise so that you do have a product to sell so that people have a vehicle to experience you for $1,000 or $2,000 before they wind up trusting you with their business.
Oh, absolutely. I've done that. The product is in place. That's fine. I have e-books. I'm developing more e-books and more interviews and more content. Those products will always be out there. But again, it's on a continuum. It's a product continuum, basically. I have those products, but because of how I've always worked, I like to work with the business owner. If he has a $39 e-book, but he's selling $24,000 a month worth of small e-books, okay, that's something that if we got him a 10% bump, he's happy. 20% bump, he's happy. 30% bump, he's very happy.
Yep.
So, again, it really comes down to economies of scale. If you have the same $39 e-book, but you can't seem to sell more than four, that's problematic.
That's funny. Are they willing to give you equity for that type of improvement, or how do you usually work your consulting deals?
Usually I'm looking for some type of equity. Maybe not equity in the company, but a percentage of everything that I produce via the system that I produce.
Right.
And that works great because then I'm constantly challenged, though, how can I do this better and what else can I do? And it just builds. You can have a situation where you may come in with a retainer of, say, $1,000 a month and you start, but when you're done building it, it's $10, $15, $20,000 a month. And you can do that multiple times. It's a matter of taking the same resources and redeploying them. Something called feature transfer, where you can take something from one situation and use it somewhere else.
What do you mean?
I was talking to a guy the other day, case in point. We were putting together a demo video of doing a Taguchi test, the actual setup. Here's what you look for, here's how you do it. One of my students is putting this together. And what I told him is go ahead and do that and speak what you see there as one part of the video. Then I want you and I to have a conversation while we look at the very same experiment when my insights are piggybacking on top of your insights. And let's see what happens. I got that because I was watching a DVD of The Matrix. They had the commentary of the people who are in the movie or produce the movie speaking as the movie is going.
By the way, The Matrix, that's like the coolest movie I didn't understand.
That is, the bad thing is I watched Matrix probably once a month. For some reason, I think that I understand something there. And every time I see it, I see something different. One of the things that Morpheus said there was, you're in a situation where there are rules, but you can bend them, again, depending on your thinking and your belief in bending them. See, so really when it comes down to in a business, what can you do? The question really becomes, what can't you do or what can't you try? And if you do something different with the business, you will get a different result.
You really open up people thinking about their businesses. They tend to become very myopic, and you've got all of these optimization and innovation tools, and you really open up their thinking about it.
Oh, yeah, it's great when you're sitting there with the business, and you say, well, did you ever think about doing this, 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 and that? And they look at you like, no. And then you put the pencil to paper, and it's like, well, that's an extra $30,000 a month. Easily. That's low-hanging fruit.
Right.
Or they think they have one market, and you identify three. You just increase their exposure 3X in one conversation.
Gotcha.
And it's great when you see that the light bulb go off. Now I got to ask you a bunch of questions.
Okay.
How does your methodology differ from mine?
I think that the primary way is that this is something that you do usually before you roll out a product, sometimes even before you develop a product, but before you roll out a product or when you want to totally reposition a product in the market. For existing sales processes, when you kind of know that there are some different needs in the market and you feel like there's several different kinds of customers, but you're not quite sure how to break them up into groups and you'd really like to be 100% confident, that's one of the places my method excels. I do some of the things that you do as well. I mean, after I've gone through all of my surveys and my coding and my regressions and I'm up with something that's profitable, well, that's when I start to do Taguchi testing and other kinds of multivariate. So I certainly don't ignore your end of the world.
Good.
That's one of the main differences. The other difference is that I'm testing to a large extent based upon what people say. And there can be some danger in that, because what they say is not always what they do. In fact, there's usually a discrepancy, but I compensate for that by looking at the percent of survey completion, which is an action, as opposed to the words that they use in the survey itself. I get very involved in looking for hyper-responses, because when you follow the 80-20 rule to its natural conclusion, you find that about half the profits in any business come from 1 or 2% of the customers. And so when I'm running a survey, I have a lot of different measures to figure out how responsive people might be. Like, do they really engage in the answers to their questions? If you ask them their most important question about healthcare or something like that, do they give you a three-paragraph answer or is it just one or two words? Will they leave you their phone number? Because people that will leave you their phone number are interested in more of a relationship and really have a more significant problem they want you to solve. And I look at relationships between multiple utterances, meaning that when you ask people what's their most important question about something, like their most important question about healthcare, and they kind of ignore that question and they give you three or four responses or even two responses, well, that means that there's these things that are bursting through their head. What's interesting is that if you look at the relationship, it's a low-level relationship, but if you look at the correlation between, you know, if someone says this and someone says that, if they say more than one thing, that's how you can piece together what the search continuum looks like and how the conversation evolves in their mind. So I could illustrate more clearly with guinea pigs. Usually if you're asking someone their most important question about guinea pigs, the vast majority of those questions are going to be like, how long do they live and what do they look like and are they safe for kids and stuff like that. But then you're also going to get a couple of questions about cages and healthcare and do they have anything contagious and do they smell and things like that. If you see that Well, the people that are asking how long they live also tend to be the ones that are asking, do they bite? You know, that there must be some underlying issue there.
Mm-hmm.
I will start to look for underlying factors by looking at the relationship between those multiple utterances. If you code these open-ended questions into categories and you use correlations,
mm-hmm.
there's a simple function in Microsoft Excel mm-hmm. you can use called correlations,
mm-hmm.
and then you pick out all the significant correlations and you see what patterns they form, it really tells a story about the market. I think that's probably something that I'm doing that you're not doing.
I was sitting there thinking here as you were talking. You speak a lot to how people feel, what they say about those feelings. Me, I just look at what they do. You have such a powerful position because people act on feelings, and you're finding out what they are, finding out what the conversations or the concerns that they are before they move to action. You actually catch them pre-action.
Yeah.
I had to write that down. You actually catch them pre-action. So you know what the powerful conversation is before you even begin to start to really engage them.
I'm looking for the emotional hot buttons and the language that's associated with it that really motivates them to purchase.
Mm-hmm.
I want to know what the story is that they need to hear and how do I prove it to them that this is a trustworthy and reliable source.
Now, okay, now you just said this. See, from a buying facilitation side, what I'm looking for to put on my site, I call it trust and credibility. So I'm always looking for what do I need to show, prove, or demonstrate. See, we come in the same spot.
Yeah.
What do I need to show, do, or demonstrate to this viewer in this moment in time, such that they make the assessment that it is safe for them to move forward with this transaction with me at this time? I mean, that is my goal. When I'm on that page trying to make it, that's all I'm trying to do. Subsequently, putting together, for lack of a better term, connecting the dots or putting those items on the page so the question can come up and be answered. It can come up again and it's answered. I think we're both looking to get that done. It's just we're going at it different ways. I'm now starting to see what we do, Kevin. Thank you so much.
Absolutely.
What kind of results are your students getting, people who've taken your course in that time?
Oh, people are doing terrifically. The hardest problem I have is getting people to actually implement, but the ones that do, they're all getting great results.
Excellent.
I'm convinced that this is the easiest path up the mountain.
Mm-hmm.
Even though it's kind of long and steep, I'm convinced it's the easiest, most sure way up the mountain. So I just don't balk at it, and I dig in and I do it. But I think that a lot of my students, like no one refunds. I've had maybe one refund altogether of the main course that I've had.
Right, and I've had none on my side.
Yeah. They all said, this is amazing. This is, you know, marketing information is going to last me a lifetime. But it's only like 20 or 30% of the people that actually
execute.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. This is the first time that I'm really launching a teaching product. And so I don't know if that's the statistic that people get for every teaching product or if it's just because there's a little more labor involved with my teaching product. I wish that I had more people that were out there and executing, because quite frankly, I'd like to joint venture with them. I would like more people to really thoroughly understand what I'm doing and have proven it so that I can slowly form a larger company that can execute more effectively in larger projects.
I understand. We had the same goal because my initial goal was to sell product, show people what the thinking was, the methodology was, so that when these other clients would come, I would be able to hand them off and deploy. But I found the very same thing. What I'm finding is execution is key. So what I've been doing for the last 6 months is developing tools and or thinking so that people do execute, developing systems so that people actually will do the test. I mean, the worst thing to say is, yes, I know I should be testing. It would really make a difference, but I'm not.
Right.
Wait a minute. You know you should, but you're not. Okay, do a one-legged test. Monitor your site. Change something on it and find out if it made a difference or not. And I'm finding that people don't even do that. And I'm finding that people say, oh, my gosh, it's working. And I think they're fearful that if they do anything different, it will work less.
It's amazing to me how many people just don't keep a testing diary.
Mm.
Make a copy of your site before you change anything.
Exactly. Yeah.
Push a button, but make a copy, put it in another folder, write a little note in your testing diary that you saved a copy of the control. And if you screw anything up, you just
put it back.
That's all you do. I'm amazed at how many people don't do that and all the horror stories I've heard about people that have tweaked their site into oblivion. Really, one of the wonderful things about the internet testing is that you can copy everything.
Put it back.
Yeah. You can work with a safety net.
Doc ordinarily works in the direct marketing side. When you print that thing out and you put it in the envelope, it's gone. I mean,
right.
You can't do anything else. It's done. It's in the magazine. It's gone into the mail. And I gravitated to the online marketplace just because of the fact that if I made a mistake, I could fix it instantaneously.
Right.
I mean, oh, the phone number's not there. Okay, hold on. Oh, there's a typo there. Oh, okay, hold on. And I don't think that people really understand that the Internet as a media is the perfect test platform. It's low cost, if you know how to do that. It's easily changeable, so you can always put things back and or change in a heartbeat, in a minute. And I don't think people really understand the power in that.
It's 100% trackable.
Oh, my gosh.
And there's no real incremental cost other than a little bit of time for adding variables and options to your test.
Exactly. So to start with your methodology and to know exactly what conversations people are in, do the surveys, know what they're talking about, and then have the language. And then apply that language into a multivariable, multivariate Taguchi tracking methodology. I'm really starting to see it now. I'm convinced it's the best of both worlds. I mean, you could really go into a market and completely just take it over.
Yeah, which is what's been happening. I mean, we're taking over the world, my friend.
Well, we'll have to get together and do some different things in the future. But, yeah, between the two of us, I think that between the two methodologies, anyone who would apply both, be diligent, learn both, learn the thinking for both, I think could really completely take over their market and not think too much about it.
Sure. Well, this has been fun.
Okay.
This has been terrific. We can do this again.
Very good.
Thanks very much for your time and attention. If you'd like to find out more about the comprehensive marketing research system I've used to succeed in market after market, please visit howtodoubleyourbusiness.com. That's howtodoubleyourbusiness.com.